Hello, and welcome back to this week's episode of Criterion Deep Dives, here during spooky season, where we're particularly focused in on Halloween scary movies, horror movies, too. So, big day today. This is our first threesome episode. You know, everyone wants to have some special people for their first, so I wouldn't rather have anyone here than my current guests, Steve Vaccaro. Hello, Steve.
Mike, thanks for having me.
For sure. And also with us is Robbie Yankish. Hello, Robbie.
Hello. I'm glad to be back on the pod.
Yes. Yeah, so avid listeners of this program will notice that our two guests have previously been on the pod. So while doing the Halloween programming, I wanted to maybe invite some others back on and not limit my future lineup to just Halloween movies. So I said, let's, you know, this is a pod about experimentation. So let's experiment with bringing some guests back on. And
I like know what Logan harped on it, but it was so easy to pick a film this time.
Yeah, was it?
Just having a smaller, like, pick anything is just like the hardest thing ever. Like, oh, pick a horror movie on Criterion. Instead of 1,200 films or whatever it is, it's like, all right, here's 70 on the streaming app.
For sure. So Robbie picked the film. And I agree, too, because it's interesting. I didn't even necessarily realize that there was a genre filter and that, you know, the idea that like a lot of these movies would kind of resist like being labeled a genre in a lot of ways, but it's helpful, you know. And I think there was like 90 some movies categorized as horror. Steve, I don't know if you heard, but The Lure is technically a horror movie on the Criterion Channel. So you have a genre affiliation, but yes, but Robbie, Robbie, come on the pod, pick a horror movie or something that is pertinent for Halloween. And Robbie, what did you pick for us today?
Well, it was a hard process and I was going through a lot. I was going to audible last minute and do The Blob, but I didn't want to do something too campy and something
Blobby
I haven't
Yankish.
Already seen, Blobby Yankish. But I went with Videodrome.
Mm. Okay, so Videodrome. This is a movie from 1983 directed by David Cronenberg.
Our dude.
Yeah, right? So I think Robbie and I discussed our film class that we had together back in college, and we watched another film from Cronenberg called Existenz, which sounds like a penis enhancement pill, but it's actually like a video game movie sort of. I don't really remember a ton of the details. Robbie, do you remember?
I don't. The only thing that like sticks out to me from Existenz to Videodrome, which we'll obviously get into, is the gun. Like, weird guns. That was the only thing that
They also had like fleshy guns that got attached to their hands. So
yeah, it was just very that's a
but that
that's
was
the, that's the IMDb trivia director trope. That's like the like weird gun.
Yeah, so I always knew that like Cronenberg, I haven't seen a ton of his movies actually, which was weird. I thought I had seen more, but I'd seen Existenz, and then I've also seen Eastern Promises, which isn't necessarily like in the same vein. That's the one with like Viggo Mortensen, and it's sort of more like a spy movie or whatever. But I knew that this was kind of his vibe in terms of like body transformation and body horror grotesque. I think his most well-known, like, to a mainstream audience film is The Fly with Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, definitely. That and Scanners is when I, Cronenberg, I'm like, yeah, I know those two at least.
Yeah, so, and then I had first heard of this movie back in high school, actually, I think, when I read the book Infinite Jest, which has a similar plot line to it with actually the titular Infinite Jest is the name of a movie in that book that the main character's father creates, and it's basically the same thing where you watch this movie and you basically like go into a catatonic state and you have no will to live, and so it's kind of a similar concept there. But anyways, that was kind of my everything I knew about this movie, and I've been meaning to watch it for a long time. Steve, had you ever heard of this movie or this director?
No.
When we told you to watch this movie, what did you like? What were your thoughts going in? Like, in terms of what it looked like, what were you expecting?
So I think my initial thoughts really started when I started the movie and I heard the music. It was very like, it just brought me back to like a place of just watching a spooky movie with like a lot of minor themes, a lot of clashing dissonance in the music. That just put me to a place where I'm like, okay, this is going to be spooky and you're probably not going to like it that much because it's going to freak you out.
and Steve, did you see in the credits music by Howard Shore? Because I know you're a film score enthusiast. So so that's pretty cool.
The music was really good. Like it did its job.
Yeah, it definitely set the tone. And it's interesting too, like what you were saying, like, oh, I know I'm not gonna like this. I know it's gonna scare me. Which like, did you feel like as the movie went on, it was kind of like scaring you in the way that you expected, or was it kind of different than what you expected?
Yeah, no, it definitely did its job. And also, today's a Monday after a long weekend. I have Monday scaries, and then this like anxiety. This movie where like it kind of plugs into like real life, like emotions and themes, and I was like, "Holy fuck!" Like my anxiety's like, hitting me right now.
I really feel that. Like how timeless is like the overall themes of this movie. It's just insane how relevant it is today, how much it holds up.
Yeah, this movie's definitely not like an anxiety salve, and I don't know if a lot of Halloween movies are. I mean, I do think that like a traditional sort of like scary movie that is more jump scares, like haunted house style, can be kind of cathartic when you go through the experience and it ends. You know, it kind of is that escapist fantasy. This movie's obviously like a lot headier, more interested in like questions of philosophy and media and these things, but I think also still manages to be like a pretty entertaining sort of action film or mystery type film, even as weird as it is. So
it's so hard to pin down a genre for Videodrome. Just like it's not like you wouldn't like thriller, horror, psychological thriller, something like that.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi, exactly. But Steve, no, I like your one point about like the music really setting up the theme. But isn't there something just so like just nostalgic feeling and good feeling about like a film from the 1976? Like I've been watching so many overproduced movies, Marvel movies, Tenet lately and stuff like that, like Chris Nolan movies, and then like hearing like the Foley effects of them like walking outside and just like the indoor sequences and like how it's not like super sharp, it's like a soft film, you know what I mean? I get really quick
Before we get to Steve, I just have to mention Robbie mentioning Foley, because when I did audio production classes in college, we had to do Foley, which is recreating the sounds that are being made, like footsteps and doors. And I think I had Robbie do some Foley, and he was like obsessed with it for about a day. Of like, I'm gonna be a Foley artist when
it's
I'm older.
It's my true calling.
Yeah,
but like just that low budget, just overall look and vibe, but just feel of the movie. It's like we're so far removed from that. Watching anything modern nowadays, and it was kind of refreshing, like, you know, in
it's
actually
a little
practical
like
effects.
Fuzzy, like the sound is like, you can, like you said, it's just not as crystal clear as things now.
Yeah, this movie feels like very much like the 80s to me, obviously, in like a lot of ways. And one thing about the 80s when I think about films is that like they are not necessarily aesthetically pleasing to me. Like I love the look of a lot of American films from the 70s and like what they were doing with cameras and like really wide lenses and stuff like that. Like what I meant was a lot of really telephoto lenses. Like I think of a lot of cool shots that are just like really fuzzy and grainy in like a really pleasing way. And I think movies from the 80s were like really, really sort of like when video started to become a thing, right? Like I was reading about this movie and all of the stuff that like the film Videodrome itself, the like torture porn and all of the video effects that happened in this movie were shot on actual video, like digital video. But the movie itself, I believe, was shot on film still. And it was this kind of like weird transition inflection point, I think, for a lot of filmmakers in terms of like, do you embrace video or do you reject it? And I think that like, obviously the themes in this movie and what Cronenberg was interested in also have a lot to do with what was happening at the time for like a film director, you know. But I think to that point, it's like they're on video, it's shot differently, the colors are very like harsh and intense, and you have a lot of movies shot in like they go back to more of a square aspect ratio, like a 4:3 for television or for video, you know, like not as much of an emphasis on widescreen. But I still like find a way to embrace them in the sense that they feel really grungy, and they like, I do think that they remind me of other movies from childhood too, like in the late 80s and early 90s. Like, I don't know why, but I'm kind of thinking of like the Ninja Turtles movie with like,
dude, it's so funny. Like you mentioned like a children's film, because I was thinking like Baby's Day Out or something like that, and just like, yeah, all these dumb city movies we watch as kids, but that just like immediately resonated with me in any outdoor shots. It's like, wait, I'm like, this is, yeah.
What is Baby's Day Out?
All right, that was a weird deep reference to pull on the Videodrome podcast. We're gonna skate right past this, but we're on the same page in terms of like, that was like my go-to like little kid movie was Baby's Day Out.
I thought you might have been referring to Babe Pig in the City.
Yeah, whatever, yeah, but that's what I meant. But yeah, you know what I mean. But just in terms of that like aesthetic and that, yeah, yeah, in like just, yeah.
Steve, were there any other movies like kind of on that same subject? Were there any other movies that when you started watching this, it kind of reminded you of like the same vibe or anything along those lines?
Yeah, there's actually a movie that I thought of almost immediately was Incredibles 2.
Okay.
With the Screen Slayer, the main villain in that, actually, it's a very similar theme and endpoint. So not on the same lines of Ninja Turtles or Babe's Night Out, but
Babe's. Wait, can you explain this, the Screen Slayer? Because I don't actually think I've seen Incredibles 2. Robbie, have you seen Incredibles 2? Okay.
Yeah, so the main villain in Incredibles 2 is it's just like a TV that you watch and takes over people when you watch the specific TV show, and it turns out it was just someone all along under like a mask or something like that. So it was just almost the same exact plot. It was great.
Imagine like the writer for Disney just like, fucking, I want to write real stuff, not Incredibles 2, and he's just like totally ripping off Cronenberg as he's writing Incredibles 2. He's just
but I think that happens a lot of times, like in children's movies and TV and stuff, where they like to sneak, like I think of SpongeBob too, right? Like SpongeBob like get tons of references to things in that, you know, is obviously like, none of this stuff is in a vacuum. Like people who write stuff for kids or for different audiences are still like adults watching the same movies and TV that we all are interested in. And, you know, just cause you're doing one thing, you may have like crazy artistic aspirations or whatever, but, that's interesting. And I love the way that a lot of animated films like The Incredibles can like, just, they can really devise cool plots like that in a way that like, they don't have the hurdles of filming with people and like, how are we going to do that? And that was something about this movie that was really interesting, because I don't know if you guys watched any of the like supplementary material that they had on here, but there was like several behind the scenes docs and like little featurettes on the making of this movie. And a huge part of it was the different effects teams, the video effects, like kind of like I talked about, there was a whole team that was sort of devoted to filming those video drum sequences, and like the media guy Barry Oblivion and his sequences. And then there's a whole nother effects team that's in charge of the essentially the makeup and the physical practical effects, like how they're gonna do the guy's stomach slit and stuff like that. So it was seemingly like pretty cutting edge stuff in terms of how they were figuring out how to do this and make it look believable. So I think, of course, Robbie, to your point, and like the way that you watch these things, that is a huge part of this movie, is just the effects that feel really real. It's like the same thing with like, you know, the difference between like Yoda in the original Star Wars series where he's a puppet, and then like the early 2000 new Star Wars movies where Yoda is like super CGI, and it's just like there's that, you know, the uncanny valley, right? The disconnect.
Right.
But
I know, like that's why it's like, when it was so weird, because I don't watch a ton of horror, and the horror I've watched in the past 3 years you know, was is probably a modern age horror, nothing real old. And like seeing blood, seeing guts, and seeing that one like shot of the hand, you know, with the gun and like the stuff going around it. I'm like, ooh, I like, you appreciate that stuff so much more than just, you know, like, you don't want to sound like the guy, like, I hate CGI, I like all practical effects, but it was actually super refreshing. And I'm like, I really dug it for that. And it looked really good.
Yeah, for sure. And I think also, like, you can appreciate CGI. Like, I do. I love, like some of the movies that are coming out today are just amazing. Like, I think about the most recent Star Wars movie, which I know, like, a lot of people did not like. But just from a CGI perspective, it's really incredible. It's incredible. Yeah. It looks so good. So, but, yeah, there's that middle period when they're the technology is new and they're starting to figure stuff out. Like, the Rock and the Mummy or whatever, like that famous shot. It's just like, what is this? So this is really cool. I think is that like a cool turning point. And you know, the guy who did the special effects, that who headed up that team, seemingly is like pretty well known. His name was Rick Baker, and he did a lot of effects for like other horror movies. Like one that I saw the scene of the transformation of was an American Werewolf in London. And it's cool. They did it all practically of this guy, the actor transforming into a werewolf. And it's just really cool to see how they do that. So, but yeah, so anyways, Videodrome, Robbie, what about you? Like when you first turned it on, what are your initial thoughts in terms of like how it's going and your expectations versus what is happening?
So after just pouring through all the movies on Criterion, Emily goes to bed and she does not want to watch a horror movie with me. Cannot blame her. And, I put on Videodrome and then, I really start digging it. As you know, we touched on the vibes it's given off already of reminiscing from childhood in terms of movies like this. And I thought the first half hour, I was actually really digging the pacing and how they're introducing the characters. And I really like the first half hour in terms of setting everything up, because that's always like the drag of horror movies is like, okay, here's the fourth plot at the beginning, now let's get into the murder and the slasher and stuff like that. But they kind of go within the first 10 minutes onto that like the radio show segment with Oblivion and stuff, and you get some cool characters there. Yeah. So I really appreciated the first, and I really went like just uphill from there on the movie. I want to say I really enjoyed this movie. This is, I'm really happy I watched it.
Yeah.
I thought they, in the beginning, when they were alluding to his connect, like just liking kind of like violent sex and like the ear piercing scenes, it was interesting. It was kind of sexy, but I think it did a really good job of like showing who this guy was and what he liked.
Yeah.
And it led a good bridge to like the other things to come.
Yeah. I know what you mean, right? Like I personally was very repulsed and on edge by the ear piercing part of it.
I liked it. I think I might try it.
But there are other moments that are definitely sort of like I thought the TV stuff was actually weirdly like erotic. You know what I mean? Like giving a human like fleshy element to the TV, which is of course, yeah, like he sees her on the TV later in one of his hallucinations. And I think it's kind of like a staying shot. Like it's the thumbnail on Criterion is sort of like him with the TV bulging out fleshy and he's kind of like entering his head into it. And, it's like super weird, but it definitely has that quality to it. I would say that like the beginning for me is, Robbie, I think like you mentioned the pacing of the film and everything. And I do think that it felt very, it didn't feel that weird or out of the ordinary for probably the first maybe 30 minutes. Like it felt like a normal sort of,
right. Yeah. There was nothing supernatural.
Like it felt like a newsroom or a guy who is, you know, like doing his job or whatever, and the dialogue was really snappy. And obviously like the most notable person in this film is James Wood, the actor, who I thought it was like really interesting and maybe semi-ironic that he's in this movie, because it's like he's a notable sort of like
right winger, isn't he?
Yeah, like, yeah. Not even just right winger, like QAnon loudmouth on Twitter, like just crazy, like sort of like just spouting conspiracy theories. Like, everybody's like, James Wood is canceled, whatever. But
that's
but
Max.
That's the main character. And I actually just watched another movie on Criterion with him in it, which is The Virgin Suicides, where he plays Kirsten Dunst's father in that movie. But he's good. He's really good in both of those movies. He's good in this movie. And I just thought it was kind of ironic that they're sort of dealing in this weird world of like pornography distribution and talking about like morality and stuff, because that is kind of like a big part of his sort of the whole QAnon thing, right? Is sort of like children and pedophile sex rings and whatnot. And I'm like, oh, it's kind of ironic that he's distributing.
He's stars in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So for some background, Max Wren, the main character, he's the head of a UHF, you know, sort of, how do you call it? Like an underground TV station in Toronto, which I also didn't realize that this was Toronto until
that's why I put on the board on behind.
Maybe I'm near the end.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, because like you're thinking like, oh, this is just obviously New York City, and then you're like, yeah. Oh wait, it's Toronto. And he has Channel 83, and they're known for softcore porn, pretty much. And right. And he wants something with more bite to it, but more, yeah. Like I love how he describes what he wants. Like he goes to this one, like producer who's distributing a new TV show, and he's an Asian guy, and it's like this weird Asian porn
samurai
porn
dreams
film. Yeah, Samurai Dreams. And and he's like, do you want to see episode one? He's like, my viewers aren't watching episode one. Give me the fun, like give me episode 13. I want to see the finale. And it shows like this girl. It's a very odd opening. It's just funny to see that like this is what Max Wren wants on his channel.
There's a little like wooden doll in like a kimono, and it like takes off the hair and the dress, and it's just like big like wooden penis. Which apparently like David Cronenberg just like carved that himself the night before. He was like, oh, we need this prop. And this guy who was on the set was like, oh, I didn't realize that that this was a thing, that like Japanese culture was so erotic. And he's like, oh, I just made that up. I just like carved that last night and put that in there. But yeah, I think like Robbie, to that point, it's interesting too, because he has like a morality about it. Like he what does he say? He's like better on TV than on the streets. And he's kind of describing this of like, which is kind of an argument we hear about like violent video games or like any sort of pornography, right? Or any sort of like taboo that is sort of like, oh, you know, if people have these like dark urges, that they should be able to like do them or live them out in like a safe way, right? Versus like the temptation to do bad things. And I think, of course, that's not a given by any means. I mean, a lot of people would really bristle at that. Like, it's a question of like morality and public interests and purity and whatnot. So that's kind of like his take on the world of, you know, pornography and TV and distribution and whatnot.
Right.
And then there's also like I think another element too is this woman Nikki that he becomes slightly like romantically involved with at the beginning. They meet on a TV roundtable where they're discussing like the effects of, they're kind of talking about this, right? They're like talking about the effects of violence on society, and they're joined by this media mogul Brian Oblivion, or this media critic I should say, who's on a television. And I thought this was amazing. Like, I love this line. He's like, I refuse to appear on television unless I am on television. Where it's like this double layer of like, he can only be inside the TV on TV. It's like kind of just a goofy like satirical thing. But this woman Nikki, she kind of has her own weird exploitative programming as well, where it's like when he goes to meet up with her, when they're about to go on a date, she's like on the phone, and you think that she's almost doing like a crisis, like a suicide hotline, but then
seek,
you realize,
help, call this number, find this, and she's like grandstanding real hard, like on how to help out this lady. That's where I'm going.
Yeah, yeah. And then like you realize when the call is over that it's like kind of like a radio play just for entertainment. So I think that kind of fits in too, in terms of like, you know, it's exploiting something, right? Like there are people who have real trauma and real issues that would call like a number like that. And it's sort of like playing it off for entertainment, you know, in the same way that like true crime documentaries are about real people's lives and we consume them for entertainment because they are entertaining. But, you know, so I think there's like some cool elements going on there. Yeah. And then basically like this signal that he's picking up, which is allegedly coming from Malaysia, and it's showing like hardcore torture porn basically. And he's like, yeah, we need to show this because, it's edgy. We need something like new. And, he's kind of bored with this, like with some of these like softcore porn, producers that are coming to him with it, with their programming. So that's kind of the start of it, right? And I do want to say that like those films felt just super like seedy to me, you know, like even knowing it was faked and seeing it, but it's like, it's really low quality. It's kind of this really like intense looking dungeon room. It's like,
it was like the Red Room from like Firewalk with Me or something like that. It was like so creepy. It was just, and it was like a girl, just like a guy on chains and just getting like beaten, killed, raped or anything like that. What do you think of that, Steve?
The Videodrome, like videos, that stuff that you're talking about now, it really matches with Max's personality. Like it's what you'd think he would be into, just by like what you learn about him from the beginning, and it's just kind of, it's like it all makes sense when he's like, you could see it in his eyes, like when he watches it for the first time.
I know, like Max is like, this is the next step. This is what I want. Like this is what I've been looking for. Like he wants death on TV.
Yeah, it for sure. And I think once again, it's important to remember like the time period and the fact that like when people would like see new things on television or whatever, it was also new. Like there wasn't the internet. So like even the idea that something like this could exist, whether, you know, staged or real or whatever, which is, of course, is a key part of the plot, is like really shocking. And I think like he's just drawn to the shock of it. Like he knows it's like an era of simulation with overstimulation with like video and television and broadcasting. So yeah, he's definitely drawn to it, and he's trying to figure out like what's going on, where it's coming from. And, his assistant Harlan actually reveals to him, he's like, no, I actually figured it out. It's not coming from Malaysia. It's coming from Pittsburgh. And there he's like even more intrigued, right? And
yeah, and then it's super interesting because then he starts like getting obsessed with Videodrome and the content and wanting to push it out. He's recording it, and then his new girlfriend, like they both just get super super into it, and like that's, and she gets super more aggressive and violent during sex, and what, and wants more done with her. She's seeing these people on the screen on Videodrome, like from the recordings, like being whipped and like beat and stuff. She's like, that's what I need. That's what I want. Like I can take that. You know what I mean? Like, it's just such a juxtaposition of like what her job's supposed to be. This like, this moral like person who's like a talk line host trying to get people through tough times. And she literally wants to go like beyond the most like violent show like no one's ever seen before. I like that part of it. That's funny. I really liked her character.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause she also, she basically sees it, and then she's leaving that night, and she's like, or when she finds out it's in Pittsburgh, she's like, I think I'm going to go audition for it. Like I'm leaving Max. So that's the last he sees of her essentially, because she goes to Pittsburgh to apparently be on the show. And then later on, he sees her on it. Right. He sees her being killed on it. And, It's soon after this that that softcore pornographer woman Masha, who has the she has the Greek like Apollo and Dionysus, which I liked. Like I just loved those like that in the Samurai Dreams, like you said, sort of juxtaposed against the like insane visuals of not only Videodrome, the inside the movie, but the movie itself and the stuff that happens. It's just sort of this like, yeah, this fantasy world, you know. I really liked this was like one thing that this is a small thing, but I loved this like little piece of editing that happened where it was the night after one of their like entanglements. And she put out a Nikki puts out a cigarette on herself, like burns herself on the chest with her cigarette. And then the next day, Max is at lunch with Masha trying to get more information on Videodrome because she apparently knows about it. And in the middle of their conversation, she's lighting a cigarette, and there's just like a quick close-up cut to the cigarette and to the smoke, or like the burning. and then like back to max. And I thought it was just like,
I totally missed that. That's awesome though.
I caught that, Mike.
Yeah. That's awesome. It really stuck with me because it like, I thought it was this really effective use of, just this idea of like when your lens changes, right? Like you see an everyday thing, but it has a new meaning. So, for him, like he's kind of like getting super engulfed in this world of like sadomasochism and, both on video and in his own, you know, in his own life. So, but yeah, so another thing that happens, and then I wasn't clear, maybe you guys would understand this better, but the cathode ray mission, which is a also sort of like a funny, ironic concept, right?
I really enjoyed that. It's like literally they take like, oh, we can like fix homeless people and put them in a better direction if we if they get a like 2 to 3 hours of TV per day. That's like the whole idea of the cathode ray mission. It looks like a soup kitchen, but instead of like feeding people or like giving people a place to stay for the night, there's just TVs everywhere for homeless people.
Yeah, and it's and it has like the logo of the like Sacred Heart or whatever the mission, like so it's like has Christian roots or whatever, right? But I couldn't tell. Were you guys able to follow, like, was that also in Toronto or was that supposed to be in Pittsburgh? Like, did he ever go to Pittsburgh?
I don't think he ever went to Pittsburgh. I thought that was in Toronto in town because like that's where. I just thought that was all in town because like he goes there and then at the end of the movie he runs to the spectacle place from there. So
that's
spectacular optical,
yeah,
which we'll hit in a minute. But no, that's cool because like he goes there, he's trying to get behind Videodrome and figure more out and distribution, and that's where Max's dive starts. You know where this is where as a viewer, like you know the 20 minutes after that scene of when he's meeting up, figuring out that Dr. Oblivion died months ago or whatever, or no, I think that was a little later in the film, but,
I think it was when he first, I think it was actually when he first went there. Cause he requested to speak with Brian Oblivion and he got to meet with his daughter Bianca instead. And she shows him the library where there's like tens of thousands of cassette tapes that, her father made before he died, and that's why he only appears on television so Steve, what did you think of like when you first saw the cassette tapes and like this idea of this person like living on in that way? Because I think that that's sort of part of the point of it too, right?
Is that's
like
the new
video
flesh.
Videos yeah right video is this like way you can like live on after you're dead or whatever.
There is this one point in there when Oblivion's talking about, but that's her dad, right? Is Oblivion?
Yeah.
He talks about something about like an enigma and like these avatars of who you are. And it reminded me of just like the whole idea of social media and like kind of what we do on the like a regular basis. But this was how many years ago?
Right. What we're doing right now on a Zoom call. You know what I mean? It's like it's this simulacrum of life. Like
I died months ago. Like that's the crazy part. This is
all timed up. Yeah, and it's like it's weird too. Like, you know, I think this is obviously especially pertinent right now with like as many video conferencing things as people are doing, but like it is this weird in between of like obviously I'm hanging out with you guys and talking, it feels like we're in the same room kind of, but then like you kind of like snap out of it and you're like, "Oh, I'm looking at a screen right now," right? And it's like it's this weird in between where it's like you feel that comfort, but you feel that distance. And of course, that type of thing has been going on since video started. But like, it's just amazing that the different ways that it can live on, you know,
it's just funny because like she mentions too, he's like, my father preferred the monologue. And like, so everything he ever said wasn't like, it was just a monologue and he recorded like six a day. So she can like keep him alive on air as Oblivion. That was really funny.
Right.
I loved how the movie went on. It got more like, it got more sci-fi. Like it started out a little more real, but then he started hallucinating and, now I liked how it got more sci-fi as he got into it.
Yeah, and like
it didn't really seem like a sci-fi movie at first, but then like with the stomach, vagina, and the
yeah, like,
yeah,
the one scene I think Robbie, you mentioned, where his hand like gets cut off, it reminded me of like Mars Attacks, like gore.
Yeah, like, oh,
I didn't see that coming.
No, yeah. Like it's so cool because like, yeah, right after we kind of find out about a little bit about like what Videodrome is too, it's a project, it's an experiment. There's like anyone who watches that or would subject themselves to watching that is the plan is to kill them. It's like they're gonna die. They're gonna grow a tumor and die, and they're gonna be, it's gonna be inoperable, and they're gonna kill off that part of the population who would ever choose to watch Videodrome. And then like once he realizes that, Max just you start losing. You don't know what's real, you don't know what's fake, because we're all seeing it from his perspective. So he's just going wild.
I almost feel like the hallucinations get worse when he becomes aware of them, right?
It's yeah, definitely.
Because he's trying to like he's informed of this by I think by Bianca, right? Or is it by
Bianca. Yeah.
Yeah, like essentially like, yeah, my father helped create this, he died of a tumor. And then he also sees like one final, it's a hallucination, right? Or maybe, and that's the fun thing about this movie too, is that like something is happening and you're trying to figure out like, is this one, is this a total hallucination? Two, is this like, this is in essence happening, but like the way that we're seeing it isn't the exact way that it's happening. Like there are a couple instances where it's like, right, like he goes and kills people, but it's happening in a way that is like fake or dramatized. Like the very, you know, near the very end, the final person that he kills is Barry Convex, the head of Spectacular Optical, and that is done in a way where apparently this handgun is like shooting out these like cancer bullets, essentially, and he's like rapid fire, like filled with cancer, and his body explodes. This is like the big sort of like makeup moment in terms of like that dude's body starts like rapidly spreading cancer and stuff like is like spouting out of his body, which is crazy. And I didn't even realize it was cancer at the time. I just thought it was like a gory thing. So, but then the other person that he kills earlier, his old partner from Civic TV, that's done in a really just normal way with a, it's done in what's really happening, right? With the handgun.
It's an office shooting. It's just like he just walks in and kills both his partners.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, and like that, like, is believable. Like, guy goes crazy, you know, brings gun in office, murders people. Like, that's just.
Right. And then, so it's like you have to imagine the, and we don't necessarily see the, like, reality of what's happening a lot, but, like, you have to imagine that whatever's happening is, like, if it's a hallucination, that something, some variant of it is happening in real life. Like, you know, and this final scene, it's like, well, I'm guessing that this guy didn't actually start like spouting cancer out or whatever. It was more like he was shot with a handgun or whatever. You know what I mean? It gets kind of confusing when it's, you start to like think about the reality of it, but,
yeah, like there's so many trivia moments. Like, what do you believe in? Like, you know, so as he's hallucinating, as he's going pretty much more insane, like there's a huge gape opening on his stomach, and it's like, obviously looks like a, Steve said it, like a vagina, and like it's a slit, that's better. He puts his handgun inside of his stomach, and like that's how, and then that comes into play later when he pulls it out of there when he's getting programmed and stuff like that. So you're thinking like, wait, was he just carrying around the gun the whole time? Or like, are we supposed to believe like
it's he's like a kangaroo, like,
yeah, he pouched it for sure.
Well, it's funny that you say that too, because it's like, of course, obviously there's the sexual element to it in terms of appearing like a vagina, but also I think even more notable is just the fact that it is sort of like this this VCR. Like later on when he's like, when the hallucinations are more prominent and he's like being shown a Videodrome tape, instead of like actually being shown it on the TV, like this cassette is shoved into his stomach. And I think that's actually when like the head of Spectacular Optical, Barry Convex, is essentially, they're really like reprogramming him. They're like, we're turning you into our weapon, and we're going to go have you like assassinate the people, our enemies, you know. Like another instance of this too, that was like really shocking when it happened, but then I was like there's all these thoughts going in my head, right? This woman from Civic TV or his assistant like comes over and they're getting in an argument, and then he just like has like a big wind up and slaps her face, and I'm like, Jesus Christ. And then I'm like well the 80s were different. And then
because she just like doesn't react, and she's like, he's like, I'm sorry for slapping, and she's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and then like when we see like the next, like he slaps her and then like slaps it back, and then when the second slap is happening, you see Nikki there in her red dress, and you kind of realize that he's hallucinating, but then he says like, "I'm so sorry, I slapped you," and she's like, "You didn't slap me. What are you talking about?" So he's starting to just like imagine violence that is not even actually.
Ooh, happening. I didn't put that through. Yeah, he is imagining violence, like what he wants to do. That's a key. Yeah, like I definitely like the highlights of the movie for me is definitely is like crazy hallucinations of like he dreams he's on the show and he gets to start like whipping like a girl and he gets to start whipping Nikki, right? And but she's inside the television and the television's made of flesh, so he's like whipping the TV flesh and it turns into the girl at the beginning of her name, the Greek girl.
I think it's actually, I think when that's happening, I think it's actually Masha, the Greek pornographer woman, who's inside the TV, and it's like also this idea that they that Videodrome, the people went and killed her too. So he's feeling like everyone around him is essentially being taken out. But another moment of like great wry humor that I love, kind of along with like the television appearance and the cathode ray mission, was when you first are introduced to Spectacular Optical, right? So it's like, it's a front, they sell eyeglasses, but he's in a cab on the way to like meet with this guy Barry Convex, and there's like a little introductory video that's played for him, and he's introducing the company and he's like, "We make inexpensive third world glasses, and also we make missile guidance for NATO." And it's just like this funny thing, I feel like, where it's sort of like the front of the just the way it's delivered and this idea that like, oh yeah, we just, you know, our profitable thing is making missile defense systems, and of course our good cause is making like these cheap glasses for the third world. Like it made me think of like companies like like Tom's and what's the one that like donates a mattress for every mattress you buy? Like
Purple or whatever, something like that. Though, like, yeah, that was definitely funny. And like, I kind of like movies where you have to kind of connect the dots with the subplot. Like, it definitely didn't just like show you, like, the subplot was that, you know, Oblivion and Convex both wanted to create Videodrome for a purpose, and their purposes definitely clashed at some point.
Right.
So he killed off Oblivion, and then Convex wanted to use it as a way to thin out humanity. And America is getting weak, and there are strong things going to be happening. We need a strong nation, or you know, America in general. So it was so interesting. Like, you could totally just watch that movie and get the first plot of what's happening with Max and what's going on with him. But I thought the subplot was super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like, Steve, I don't know if you felt this way at all, but I felt like Barry Convex was kind of like a Thanos-like character. Like, he's like he has this awesome power in his hands, and in his mind, he's, like, using it for good. He's like, no, this is for the purity of society. Like you said, Robbie, he's like, yeah, anyone that would want to watch this is, like, part of why, you know, is part of why society's going downhill, you know?
Let's give him tumors and kill him, and then, like, it, you know, we will be stronger as a whole.
Yeah,
something that I was kept on thinking about was that Max's character, like, he didn't seem all that bad at some points, and like he was searching for something the whole time, or like that. I was trying to think of like his motives and thought about like some people that he reminded me of, like kind of like aggressive people that like you're wondering like why are you so like this or into this, and like I think the cause is just like a lack of like either self-worth or like lack of, you're trying to prove something or gain something by being that way, being aggressive, or like something's missing in your life.
Right. And I mean, this was the 80s too. This is the era of Reagan, and where like the idea of like capitalism and sort of like something that these some of these directors in this roundtable I watched, including Cronenberg, were talking about, with essentially their movies getting X ratings or not, and that the MPAA, which does the ratings in America, is like reflecting the mores of the time. So they were talking about the fact that like in Reagan's world, like violence was totally okay. Like there's no problem with violence, but like if you showed any sexuality in your movie, it was not going to, it was worse, or it was more likely to get the X rating, which of course is like interesting
because of death. Like you can't make money on it. Like it's just, yeah, no one's gonna see it if it's X rating.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting too, just to think about like the morality of those things too, right? It's like, this is, once again, this is a debate we have constantly, is sort of like in culture, is this idea of like just seeing violent things on television and in video games, like do those have an impact on like younger people and on and young brains, so like wanting to do more violence or whatever? And of course, like the idea of seeing sexuality is like by certain cultures or certain people seen as a bad thing, but like it, at the same time, it's like, well, you could have a totally different view of that, and that's saying that like seeing sexual things or learning about that at a younger age is like actually an important way to like develop, you know, respectful boundaries around sexuality. So I think that is like all really cool and all tied into this movie. And like what I love about it is that it's not even like hitting you over the head necessarily with those specific talking points, right? Like it's touching on them in ways, but it, you do have to like think about it a little bit more. So there's a lot going on, I think, in terms of like the present moment in 1983 and in the culture. Like to get to the point, like he's corrupted by Spectacular. He goes and kills his partners at Civic TV, and he goes to try to kill Bianca Oblivion, but she
reprogram
him. Yeah, by showing him a video of Nikki dying, basically, I think, right? Is that when he sees Nikki dying?
Right, and like he totally snaps, and it's like, yeah, you know, like I think he knows he's toast at that point. Like he's like so far gone, but he can like maybe make a couple more decisions to stop Videodrome.
When he shot the TV of like him, was it like a kind of a double conundrum of him shooting the TV that was of him, but it was really him shooting like his, I took it as it was him shooting what's taking over his brain,
right?
And that released him from his state.
Like the final shot is of like he watches him, he's after he does all his killing and kills everyone related to Videodrome pretty much. He's on this boat. He sees a TV just appears almost, and he sees a video of him just putting a gun to his head and saying,
saying the video word made flesh.
Yeah. Death to Videodrome, long live a new flesh. And on the TV, he sees himself blowing his brains out. And I think he's reflecting what he sees on the TV, because that's just so much of a part of him now. And
right.
It's a mirror. That's the, you know, the TV is a mirror to him, and that's what he has to do. So he has to ascend to the next level, the new flesh.
Well, and it's not just the new flesh, right? It's the video word made flesh, which is a direct reference to the Bible and the idea that like Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, the higher being who comes down into a human body, right? So he's this God who is essentially willingly going down to be a human in like a lesser form. And so there is this idea, I think, being presented about the idea of like recording yourself on video, that you are taking something of a higher intelligence as a human being and that you're capturing it in this lesser form, but it still exists, right? Like your video, like a video recording of you does not have consciousness, but it is representing you. So it's so I think that there was like some cool stuff going on when they started like kind of mixing that Christian imagery in, and like you were, or that the Christian words, you know, and like you were saying, Steve, like the idea of the avatar and the representation of someone versus the actual person, you know. But yeah, it all comes to a head when he's reprogrammed, and he basically it's another cool moment where like he pulls the gun back out, and then the gun becomes like infused to his hand with these like little nail tendril things that are like spouting out of the gun.
Yeah, that was like the freakiest moment of the movie.
Yeah.
Definitely, without a doubt. I was like, well, I had to look away. It was so creepy. I was like, ugh.
And then and then he goes and he goes to the Spectacular Optical Trade Show, where there's the Fall Line, which is the Medici brand, and it's all this like medieval European branding. And this led me to think of something I wanted to ask both of you guys, because I know that for work, both of you guys have to go to trade shows sometimes, and that often they put on these sort of like goofy presentations or concerts or themes or whatever. And I wanted to ask, like, what is the weirdest thing like this that you guys have seen at a trade show before?
Yeah, I was at a trade show, and some guy just was super weird. Like, they were, like, doing this new tripod line. And this guy gets on stage and says, death to Videodrome, along with the new flesh, and just kills the presenter. So that was definitely... So that scene really resonated with me. It was funny to see, like, the 80s trade show. I'm like, all right, this is cool. this is a good climax to the movie.
Steve, have you had any... Like, I know you've talked a little... You've told me a little bit about some of these, like, big conventions that you've been at. Has there ever been anything that's sort of felt like this over-the-top presentation?
It's just always over-sexualization of either men or women. Like, it's always someone hot, and just like that's it doesn't matter what they're saying, it's just about like how they're looking.
Yeah Like, I know I've made some videos for like live events and for trade shows and sort of like these big things, whether it's like parkour or like they're gonna do some sort of performance on stage that is like wild, because they go from doing this performance to like 10 minutes later, it's like a sales presentation, you know, it's like amping up these salespeople. So, I thought that was really funny. But of course this is the scene where, he kills, Barry Convex. And then it ends with him in this sort of like old boat in the Toronto Bay. And he basically hallucinates the TV and the killing of himself. And then he does shoot himself, as he says, long live the new flesh. So yeah, there is this sort of like weird religious crusade element that goes on, in the sense of like he is this warrior for this like new religion. So I found all of that stuff at the end very satisfying, just in terms of like
right.
wrapping it up and giving it this new sort of twist. But
do you guys know if in the movie there was any music that wasn't like just like instrumental?
Yeah, it wasn't OST or anything like that. I don't think.
I can't remember.
Because I feel like I would definitely you'd recall like sticking out like because that movie's kind of I don't want to say timeless, but the message is obviously timeless. But I didn't like remember any like 80s like synth or anything like that at all.
Like sort of like a popular track of the time, yeah, or something like
definitely.
That.
I don't remember any of that.
Yeah.
I think that's what made it so suspenseful and like it brought on anxiety for me. Like, 'cause it makes it seem like more real that it's just. It's just what's happening, and then like strings, like spooky strings. There is no like, you got, like 80s summer anthem while they're driving and those smiles
right.
before someone died. It was just straight, like straight up.
Right. Some like Dire Straits or like some.
But is this cool? Like we have this like horror, you know, if we can describe it horror, but it's this body horror and it's this psychological horror that we're seeing it coming back in more ways with more modern films. Like, what's that one vacation movie where they go to the Swedish island? That's like more of that type of
horror. Midsommar?
Yeah, Midsommar. And
be sure to tune in to the podcast on Thursday where myself and another guest will be discussing the 1973 cult horror classic, The Wicker Man.
I can't wait for that.
Which is very much more similar to Midsommar, but yes, exactly.
Yeah, like I love like in dread, like jump scares are like those movies will always be campy to me. They will always like never be truly scary. There'll be some cult more classics like that. But the body horror and the psychological horror, and I feel like we're getting more of a renaissance of that style of film where. I love of like a guy like you don't know what to trust on screen. It never felt like any of the gore was forced, but it was like at the perfect time to go with your anxiety. Just the like the visceral blood on screen and the gore, like where I really did appreciate that. Like Steve and I watched Halloween 34 with Jamie Lee Curtis a couple weekends ago. It's a fun film, but you know what I mean. Like you never. It's just like it starts stop like
is that fine. The one that came out last year where it was right. like the reporters go to see Michael Myers and then like
podcast creators
podcasters
we're filming a podcast
I didn't see that, but I read about it's like funny premise. Did you guys like that? Was it good?
I like it.
Yeah, I and that's I like them too. They're like fun, but like actual, you know, getting scared and like, you know what I mean? You don't actually get scared. Like, it's all jump scares. Like,
yeah.
I love, like, like these movies are like Videodrome, you have disturbing parts and then you have like psychologically disturbing parts too, which is kind of cool. But a really good plot.
I've never seen any of the Halloweens, but I really want to, especially the first one, because like I realized that I think I saw another John Carpenter movie recently, but The Thing is like one of my favorite horror movies. The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing from a similar time period, 1982. I think it's the same thing with that movie too, where once again it's not like necessarily aesthetically pleasing, like it's just the grungy like 80s look to it too. But one other interesting thing too that I learned is that like apparently originally Cronenberg wanted to shoot a scene right after this suicide to end the movie where he's back in that little like Videodrome dungeon with Nikki and they're like making passionate love on the floor, and sort of like it's sort of like this heaven, right? This idea of like when he says long live the flesh and he becomes like into this TV realm that now he's living with her. And when I read that too, like one thing that I had kind of already thought of this movie and I like read that Andy Warhol compared it to this movie Clockwork Orange, where he was like, this is the Clockwork Orange of the 80s. And of course that movie ends kind of in a similar way where like the main character Alex is basically, he escapes from the clutches of this guy and then he's falls out a window and he's like freed of his weird like affliction that he's given where he is physically repulsed at the idea of committing evil. But it ends with him in this like heavenly cloud area with all these people like clapping on the side and him like tossing about with like these three naked women or whatever. And you know, obviously like this movie too has a lot of similarities to that when it comes to like the idea of free will and the idea of like essentially being programmed by a video, which is also what happens in Clockwork Orange, where his, you know, his eyes are forced shut and he's forced to watch the movie that essentially programs him to like feel sick when he's about to do something bad. So I love that comparison. I haven't seen that movie in a while and I would love to rewatch it. Even though, like,
Clockwork Orange, that's a two-parter, man.
I'm just so curious how that movie would like hold up watching it today, because it does feel like such a dicey movie in terms of its like depictions of sexual assault and everything, like, you know, filmed on screen. So it's, you know, in that same vein as this movie, where it's like, what are the lines of what you show on TV or not? So.
I think that the answer is just consent, and that's I think a huge difference of like that type of like sex now and then is like more like now it's more like that's
if you, that's so taboo now,
right?
But if you're consenting to it, that's the biggest thing, and like is even in like porn stuff too, like that's what should be focused on is that these people are doing this and then consenting to do it.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but it's just so funny. Like, just going back to, you know, this, like, sex on TV and movies and violence, where, you know, like, we, last week, he talked about the Empire of the Sun or whatever.
Empire of Passion?
Yeah, Empire of Passion. Like, and I watched that with Emily. Like, and, you know,
you watch the movie or?
I watched the movie. And after the podcast. And there's, like, this rape scene, you're like, oh my gosh, like that, you feel in the pit of your stomach, you're like, this isn't cool, like this is, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
maybe in the 80s, like they could, I don't know, it was probably still shocking then, but even now it's like, you know, we do have movies where, like even like PG-13 and like movies like, I think of the Marvel movies in terms of like, there's no sex or anything like that, but like, hey, seeing Gwen die in Spider-Man and her snapping her neck, like that's totally, we're cool with that. That's fine. Like that type of like super violence, watching death on TV, even if it is like a PG-13 movie, it's just it is so changed now where sex, like the sexual matters of these movies, you know, looking back at these older ones, it's so different.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too with this roundtable I watched with John Carpenter and David Cronenberg and John Landis, where they're essentially talking about this issue. And you might think, right, that like the director of this movie would be like, yeah, like there's no limits, like you should be able to show whatever, or like people should be able to see whatever. But he was like, no, absolutely, like a child should not see this movie. Like I'm okay with ratings, like I think that like people need to like, they basically pose the question to him, like, is there anything off limits? And they were talking about, as far as violence goes, that like nothing should be off limits as long as it's like earned in the context of what you're watching. So it's like, if something feels like it's just a totally there for shock and it doesn't really have a lot to do with the plot, then it's like, then it's kind of senseless violence. But like, if it's earned through whatever you're doing plot wise, then it can be powerful. Right. So, which is kind of how I feel. Although I definitely have gotten like, I definitely have gotten even more sort of like sensitive when it comes to anything with like gore and violence in movies as I've just started to get a little bit older. Like I have a harder time watching things in general than I think I used to,
like Steve likes scary movies, I think, more than both of us. I think I'm fair to say that. And I was kind of getting like looking through these movies and I'm like, man, I don't, once I'm watching it, I know I'll be fine, but I don't have the constitution for some of this stuff where I'm like, yeah. I don't think I can like handle a lot of this anymore. Like, and just, you know, especially just like the heavy gore and stuff like that. Like, that's where I'm like, I can't, I don't know. I'm getting softer as I get older. And that was just that there's some hard movies on there that I'm like, I can't, I just know I can't.
Steve, is that true? Are you a big horror movie fan?
I don't care for psychological thrillers as much.
Yeah.
Which I would kind of classify this one as. And I think it's really easy for me to separate reality from like Halloween and Jason and all that stuff.
Scream, yeah. You know what I mean? Like as a comedy horror. Yeah.
Monster, like a monster. Yeah, yeah.
Whereas with this, before like the sci-fi elements really kicked in, like there's a sense of reality to it that I thought was pretty real, which is why I didn't care for that as much.
But yeah, I mean, it's uncomfortable. It's like, yeah, what is TV doing to us? You know, it's like when you stop and think about it or whatever. But Steve, what are some of your favorite like horror movies?
So I like the Halloween series.
Yeah.
I like Scream. I like Jason, specifically being at camp, which is really fun.
Being at camp, like with, can you explain that further? Like,
yeah, it's just like it's at a camp and like it's the 80s and like funny things that they.
It's such a knowable like location too. Like, you know, like your expectations are immediately set when you're at a summer camp in the 80s of what like what's going on here, and then like adding a monster to that is like so fun. I agree with you there, Steve. I didn't like I didn't like Jason Space 2007 or whatever it was.
I don't think I've seen any of those. I really need to watch some of those old.
You need to do some of those campy older ones.
That's Halloween, like,
I like Carrie. Yeah. Poltergeist is good. The Omen.
Okay. Yeah.
But honestly, I think it's most of them with like a storyline that like with Freddy and Jason or Halloween. There's a whole storyline and backline to him, and you know it's just easy to like separate that from reality.
Right. Well, because so Halloween is Michael Myers. Friday the 13th is Freddy Krueger, or is that Jason?
Yes, that's Freddy Krueger.
Oh, it is Freddy Krueger, yeah.
Okay, and then Nightmare on Elm Street is Jason.
No, other way around. Nightmare on Elm Street is definitely Freddy Krueger.
Okay.
Friday the 13th is Jason.
Yeah.
Cool. Clearly, I'm an expert on these things.
It was funny because I was going to pick Carrie. I was looking for a Stephen King like based book on Criterion, and I could not find a single Stephen King based, like, and there's so many of them like that, but there wasn't. Like, I was looking for like Thinner or something like that. You ever see that movie's terrible. That's like a fun
I haven't seen that movie, but I remember starting to read that book because I was really big into Stephen King when I was in like grade school and beginning of high school.
I'm 27 and I'm into Stephen King now, so you're
that's
you're
fine. I don't even mean to like, I'm not even trying to like make him out to be like a juvenile author. I know a lot of people really love reading Stephen King. I haven't read as much as of late, but I know he's a great author for what he does.
I was looking for like Salem's Law, Carrie, any of that stuff. Misery. There's so many. I thought they would be on there, but they weren't.
I remember reading a Stephen King book. Probably like around the time of like 2006, maybe, I want to say, that I forget what it was called, but basically it was like this the plot was that like the cell phones were turning people into zombies, which was kind of like pertinent to this movie too, right? But it's like I remember reading that, picking that up, and I'm like, whoa, like it's like a zombie book, but it's also like a statement about society. Like, what if the cell phones are turning us into zombies, you know? So which is kind of like right in his wheelhouse, right? But yeah, he's got so many good books. So
definitely.
Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah, this was a really fun movie to watch. Thanks, Robbie, for picking it.
Of course. No, thanks for having me on. So so everyone, I'm giving two thumbs up. I like this movie. What do you guys
feel? Thumbs out of how many thumbs?
Out of two. It's a real weird weighted scale. It's terrible. You can't even.
Do you have what? Did you? Were you posing that question to Steve? Steve, do you have a rating for this movie?
I thought it was a thumb up.
One thumb up out of two thumbs? Okay.
Yeah.
I think that I would give this a 3.5 stars out of 5 stars. But I agree with like all of your guys' points just in terms of like enjoyable versus non-enjoyable. One thing I will say, and I think I forgot to mention this, but like just a breezy 90 minutes, right? Like I love these 90-minute movies that they don't waste any time. I was looking at David Cronenberg, a lot of his movies and especially like his earlier movies are also right around that 90 minutes, which just coming more and more to love that length of a movie, especially when we have these like 10-hour series on Netflix that are just interminable. So, so I think this is a great movie. Two other movies for further viewing, I think, for anyone who liked this. You may have seen these already. They're both very well known, but Nightcrawler with, what's his face? Jake Gyllenhaal, right?
Gyllenhaal,
like 2013 or something. He like works at a news station and he tries to get all the shocking violent like firsthand tapes of news that he can get. And then Network, which is a film from the 70s, which is kind of also about the idea of like what is TV and what is broadcast news doing to us. Robbie, thanks for picking this movie. Steve, thanks for joining and tuning in with us. And
thank you guys for having me, inviting me.
I think this is a great discussion about media and film. And we'll definitely have you guys back on at some point down the road.
And two more recommendations real quick. Incredibles 2, for sure, as Steve pointed out. And then Wonder Woman 1984. If you listen to this podcast and watch that, I think you're going to see some similarities based on trailers.
Have you seen it?
No, but I guarantee you're going to see some similarities, like looking at the plot description.
Okay.
And also right. Hocus Pocus.
Yes. Hocus Pocus, too.
Always. All roads lead back to Hocus Pocus. All right. Thanks guys for joining us, and we will see you later.
Thank you, Mike.
See ya.